At the age of 19, David Hatcher Childress left the United States. He went on a six-year research and adventure odyssey. He would study firsthand the ancient civilizations of Africa, the Middle East, China, along with journeying into the dangerous territory occasionally, like Uganda during the overthrow of Idi Amin. Further expeditions took him to South America, Africa, and remote Pacific Islands. This guy is called the modern Indiana Jones. Very prolific writer with some great stories. One, Atlantis and the Power System of the Gods. Now, we have this all linked up, too, on Art's website. So to save you some time, too, just go to artbell.com. You click on program, click on tonight's guest, and link up with David Hatcher Childress's website. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're really going to take you on a ride on this program tonight. My guest, David Hatcher Childress. David, I envy you because you have been to every area that I've never been, and I wish I could. They must have been exciting trips for you.
Oh, wow. Yeah, George. Well, traveling around the world and meeting people and looking for the mysteries of the past is what I like to do and is what I've spent most of my time. But unfortunately, when you're the real-life Indiana Jones, you get dragged under trucks. People try to kill you. Spend a couple of weeks in a hospital here and there, and unfortunately, I've done all that. So,
have you really been threatened?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. And, some places are just plain dangerous. Whether it's, the markets of Peru or something, down to the war-torn cities of countries of Africa, I've been there. I'm lucky to have traveled all over the world and been where I've been. I've been to places you can't go today, like Afghanistan and Somalia, Rwanda, and places like that.
What was the spirit behind you, David, that got you to travel, especially at such a young age?
Well, there wasn't the Art Bell show to listen to back then, so it had to be something else. But you know what? I grew up. I was born in France, but my parents are Americans, and I grew up in America in the Rocky Mountains. And I think that things like Johnny Quest and Kung Fu influenced me. I liked reading Ripley's Believe It or Not. I loved going to museums, and my parents had a subscription to National Geographic, and my dad liked to hike and read maps, and my parents liked to travel a lot, too. So by the time I was an early teenager, I had been to Turkey and Greece and Stonehenge and climbed the pyramids at Mexico City and things like that, and these things, led me into, like a double interest, one that was interested in archaeology and history and the mysteries of the past, and one that was also interested in the paranormal, and I had an early interest in psychic phenomena, UFOs, Atlantis, sunken cities, mysteries of Tibet, and one of the things that I've also written about quite a bit and talked about on the Art Bell Show in the past is ancient tunnels underground and some of the just weird stuff that is known to exist. I mean, like tunnels, underground cities, giant megalithic cities, and even cities underwater, for that matter. Trying to make sense of it all is what I try and do, and then that's where my books come in, like the Lost City series or Technology of the Gods or Vimana Aircraft of Ancient Indian Atlantis.
Well, and you do a good job, David, explaining that. Of all the things that you have seen and witnessed, what one thing just sticks in your mind as probably one of the most phenomenal of all?
Well, George, I'm asked that question a lot. It's hard to say any one thing in particular, although maybe a couple that leap to my mind. One is the fantastic city, literally built out of magnetic crystals, that's on a remote island in the Pacific. It's a giant city called Nan Madol, and it's built out of 250 million tons of basalt, levitated. Much of the city's underwater. I call it the eighth wonder of the world. You will occasionally see it mentioned on TV, mm-hmm. but it's it's something that archaeologists can't really explain. I mean, this massive city on this island. I write about that in my book on lost cities of ancient Lemuria in the Pacific. Another thing I think that is kind of strange and sticks in my mind that constantly baffles me too is this weird tunnel that goes underground and it starts at this city in Brazil. It's a tunnel that's known to the locals. Even the Brazilian army has gone inside this tunnel. It starts at a small tourist town that's outside of Sao Paulo in southern Brazil, the largest city in Brazil, Sao Paulo.
Sure. Right.
And this is a town called San Tomé das Letras. It's a tourist town on top of a mountain that's about a 4-hour bus ride outside of Sao Paulo. In fact, the famous soccer star, Pelé,
sure,
is from right around this area. In fact, when you go to this city, and it's a tourist town full of artists and things like that. There are hotels, but it's a small town. They will take you to this edge of this town. It's on top of a mountain, and there are quite a few rock quarries right around there. And from right at the city, this tunnel goes into the ground. And you hear a lot about weird tunnels in South America, passages, particularly around Peru and stuff like that. The Incas supposedly hid much of their treasure in these lost tunnels and things like that.
Well, how big is this tunnel?
This one in Brazil, it's large. It's the walls are like 8-9 feet high, 6 feet wide. Two very tall people can walk abreast through this tunnel. It starts at the top of this mountain. It's not blocked in any way, and you begin walking downhill. And they don't know where the end of this mountain is, the tunnel going.
Wow.
The Brazilian army has gone into this thing, according to the stories you hear at this town, they say, and hundreds of people go every day into this tunnel, although they don't go very far. They only walk a few hours or so, and then they come back. Supposedly the Brazilian army went inside this tunnel, went for days as an expedition, and eventually they came to a room underground. And that room had four different tunnels in it, and they were coming through one of them. And then, so there were now three more tunnels for them to explore. They stopped at this point, and then they returned to the surface.
Natural or man-made?
Well, this thing is man-made, and it's, you hear stories. Eric von Däniken tells a story in one of his really old books, actually, Gold of the Gods, of these tunnels in Ecuador, with the walls are vitrified and like melted rock tunnels. This is not like that. It's a red earth. It's not rock, but it's dug out, and it is man-made. There seems little question of it, that it's completely man-made. Now, I mean, one possible explanation for this, too, George, is ancient mining. Many ancient tunnels that are discovered, and there are stories, like in Utah, of miners in modern coal mines tunneling through these,
sure,
these,
yeah,
coal veins, and suddenly coming into ancient tunnels that, in other words, people thousands and thousands of years ago had been mining coal, in the same vein, and miners will discover these ancient tunnels and things like that. Peru and South America, mining, I think, is an explanation for a lot of the strange megalithic remains down there. But still, I think it's all many, many thousands of years old, but particularly the giant stone ruins, oftentimes attributed to the Incas, which I maintain in my books that the Incas didn't build most of those walls and cities down there like Machu Picchu. They may have inhabited those cities.
But they were already there, you think.
Exactly. Just like the Spanish are already occupying these megalithic stone buildings. I mean, they're built out of giant stone blocks, perfectly fitted together, weighing 50 to 100 tons. And they're not going anywhere. So, I mean, all you have to do is put a roof over these giant walls, and you've got a house or a city. And literally, cities like Cuzco are like that today, where it's one of the most popular tourist destinations in South America. But, you're in restaurants, right there in the main plaza, and these restaurants are megalithic walls.
What are the possibilities, David, of these tunnels leading into some huge cavern that, do you remember the movie Journey to the Center of the Earth, and once they finally got into the center, there was a sun and all that? I mean, is it possible that these things lead to something?
Well, Right. I mean, that's the classic story of Hollow Earth and there being a central sun, tunnels leading deep down into caves. Oftentimes these caves are lit by glowing lichens and mushrooms or something like that. In fact, I did a whole book, George, some years ago called Lost Continents in the Hollow Earth, where I discuss these tunnels in South America. Supposedly there are tunnels like this, too, in Tibet and other areas. And a lot of the, you know, mythology and legends and bizarre writings, really, to go into this Hollow Earth stuff. The whole idea that there are holes at the poles, called Symmes holes, and then stuff like that. I'm fascinated by all that. I'm not a believer, really, that there are holes in the poles, per se, and a central sun, although I'm familiar with all that material. I am a believer, on the other hand, that there really is an underground world around us and a subterranean world, and one certainly that is full of tunnels. Even the modern government is doing stuff like this. They have these giant tunnel boring machines that they literally drive through the earth.
Well, that's true. Do you think, though, with the subterranean life down there or world, that there is actual people and inhabitants down there?
Well, in the classic Hollow Earth beliefs, yeah. I mean, the Hollow Earth is inhabited. There's another world, even there are like oceans and things like that. Of course, in Journey to the Center of the Earth, there's prehistoric monsters and things like that.
Right.
I mean, there were stories, too, that Admiral Byrd had made all of these strange claims that he had gone beyond the poles in his late 40s trips by Zeppelin to the South Pole in particular. And Byrd made a lot of strange statements, that's for sure. And it's one thing that these Hollow Earth proponents point out is that Admiral Byrd spent his later life in a mental institution.
And I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's not that well known, but as I've looked into it, yeah, it is true. Byrd's later life was one that was kind of strange. He was like shut into this hospital. People were told he was crazy, and he allegedly would make all kinds of bizarre statements. And some people believe that he talked about like the Hollow Earth going through these holes in the poles. I'm not so convinced of that myself. And in fact, what is apparently at the South Pole is a Russian-American underground base. And in fact, if you watch one of those Monty Python guys, Michael Pollan, he did a series for Channel 4 in the UK, and it's shown on Discovery Channel occasionally, called Pole to Pole, where he goes in like 8 episodes, goes around the world, and goes from the North Pole, and he goes in one of the last episodes, he goes to the South Pole. And it's strange, too, because he lands his private plane at the South Pole with his camera crew.
Right.
The American government is telling him, don't land, you know, go back. He lands anyway. When he gets out of the plane, you know, he's met by military personnel. There is, in fact, a military base at the South Pole. I mean, not like on the edge of, you know, Antarctica or something. It's right at the South Pole. He's then, and his camera crew, they're taken underground to the first level of this underground base at the South Pole. It's the cafeteria, in fact, where everybody's having lunch and stuff like that. There are a bunch of Russian soldiers there and a bunch of American soldiers. And this is like in the 80s, all right?
Oh, strange.
Yeah, and this underground base goes like 9 stories underground. They won't even let him go into it. I mean, even there could be howling, you know, blizzard outside. I mean, they would never know because they're deep underground at the South Pole.
What are they using it for?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, and it's kind of the interesting thing when you start looking into Antarctica and some of the things that we do at Adventures Unlimited is the amount of cooperation between the Americans and the Russians, including space adventures, bases at the South Pole, other things like that. When even back in the 80s, when the Russians were supposedly our enemies, today they are our friends, our allies supposedly, but back then they were the arch enemy superpower that we were arming ourselves against. Yet at the same time, that we were in this superpower battle with the Soviets. We shared a base at the South Pole with them. We shared Skylab up in space with them, stuff like that. It's curious, things that Americans don't think about a lot, including Russians, for that matter.
Well, and speaking of traveling, as you have, when you've been to all these various areas, and I'm talking about when you look back into antiquity, did you find, David, any similarities in different regions of the world in terms of what they were doing in that time period that they could have been doing in South America, in Africa, and all around the planet at that time? Anything that was similar where you said, this is strange?
Well, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, one of my heroes, who just died recently, and that is the great Norwegian archaeologist Thor Heyerdahl.
Yes.
And I met Thor Heyerdahl in northern Peru some years ago. He was in his early 80s at the time, and he died. He was 89 just a month or so ago when he died. Thor Heyerdahl was, of course, one of the proponents of what is really known as diffusionist archaeology. As an archaeologist, I mean, I can tell you that, I mean, there's a huge schism today within archaeology, and it's what we're largely taught, and the American school of archaeology goes mainly along with what's known as isolationist archaeology, and that is that ancient civilizations are isolated from each other and don't have contact, and oceans are barriers. They're not highways. You can't just get into your giant boat in China or Egypt or India or wherever and cross some ocean. No, oceans are these huge barriers. But there's a flip side to that whole belief in archaeology, and that's called diffusionist archaeology, which is totally the opposite, where ancient civilizations are connected to each other, and oceans are highways, and that's the easy way to go somewhere is in a boat. And just like today, teenagers in small yachts without any navigational electronic equipment can circumnavigate the entire world by themselves. And these small yachts and things. And, of course, Thor Heyerdahl would have said, yeah, I mean, the ancient Egyptians and Phoenicians and Romans and Chinese, even the Mayans and stuff, had huge ships and giant navies, and they were perfectly capable of crossing the oceans and going places and making this connection. And that's part of the story of Atlantis, too. And, in fact, Thor Heyerdahl told me once in Peru, I asked him, specifically, I said, do you believe in Atlantis and the idea of some, you know, a civilization that's 10,000 years old, of seafarers going around the world and stuff? And he told me absolutely he believed in that. And right. To me that was significant, that a great archaeologist like him, and I believed an open-minded yet, you know, scientifically minded person too, absolutely believed in all this stuff. Atlantis, ancient seafarers, megalithic construction that was consistent throughout the world.
Absolutely, and he's been able to touch that, and he was a great man. I remember in school, Kon-Tiki was one of the first things I ever learned about past history. My guest is David Hatchard Childress. When we come back, we're going to talk about Atlantis, much more, though, than where he thinks it might be. What was it? And how did it work? And what about the power source? So stick with me. I'm George Norrie, and you're listening, of course, to Coast to Coast AM. Coast to Coast, I'm George Norrie. The topic of Atlantis has always fascinated me, always. David, in your book, Atlantis and the Power System of the Gods, you break the book down into two parts. Let's talk a little bit this hour, if we can, about part one. And tell me a little bit about that, if you would.
Right. The first part of Atlantis and the Power System of the Gods is actually largely a reprint of a friend of mine's book that's about 10 years old, and it's about the Mercury and Mercury power generators. Bill Clendenin, who co-authored that part with me, has passed away, but he had a lifelong fascination with UFOs, also with the subject of Vimanas,
mm-hmm.
and the interaction and connection between ancient civilizations and ancient India and Atlantis with the UFO phenomenon. And it's one that crops up, you know, from time to time in UFO and Atlantis literature, and I certainly write about it. Vimanas are something that every Hindu or Buddhist knows about. If you go to India or Thailand or those areas, I mean, you ask somebody what Vimana is, they all know. What Vimana is the Sanskrit word for these aircraft, these airships that are talked about a lot in the ancient Indian epics. When you read the Ramayana, or the Drona Parva, the Mahabharata, which the Ramayana is actually part of, these ancient Indian epics that are thousands of years old and have been copied over and over again by these Indian scholars and still exist today, they read like the wildest science fiction. They're like some Buck Rogers story. The story of Rama, actually, in the Ramayana is basically this prince in northern India in Ayodhya, and his wife, Sita, is more or less run off with this other guy, and for a while, Rama broods about his wife, who's missing, basically, and then suddenly he decides, yeah, he's gonna go and get his wife back. And in the story, he gets in this airship, it's called a Vimana. These are described a lot in the ancient Indian texts. It's a real nuts and bolts machine. If you go to Hindu temples or Buddhist temples, they're usually depicted as like a chariot that's being drawn through the sky by a bunch of swans or something like that. And it's that Eric von Däniken kind of chariots of the gods,
right,
motif. Well, what's fascinating, I mean, when you look into Vimanas, is that, okay, there are these ancient texts, they are talking about this, there's no question about it, but you know, what are these things? When you read the ancient epics, it's a lot like reading a modern novel, okay? The hero of your story suddenly goes to the airport and jumps on British Airways jets and flies to London. But in the novel, they don't suddenly stop and go, oh, this is what an airplane is, and describe it and tell you what jet engines are and all that kind of stuff. They don't do that because you just know what an airplane is, and they know you know, so they just tell you, yeah, you got into an airplane. And that's what the ancient epics are like, that too. They talk about Vimanas, but they don't get into detail about exactly how they work and look like and stuff like that.
What are the possibilities, David, of this being the part of a very creative, clever mind in those days, where they just made up these whimsical stories of flying machines?
Well, I mean, that's exactly what, you know, mainstream archaeologists have to say, and, I mean, you can put all that into the realm of flying carpets and, you know, thunderbirds that the American Indian legends all have,
sure,
and, you know, silver spaceships or whatever. I mean, as a matter of fact, the idea of aerial vehicles, ancient kind of like flying chariots and things, even some that go underwater, according to some of these stories, and I get into that in my book. Yeah, there are common, and it's something that's a myth that goes around the world. King Solomon supposedly had one of these airships, according to the ancient Ethiopian text, the Kebra Nagast, which talks about the Ark of the Covenant and the Solomonic heritage that Ethiopia has, and including that King Solomon used to fly between Ethiopia and ancient Israel. Well, here's the whole thing. It's like, all right, is it all just allegory to you know, like flying carpets? Well, this is what really is startling, is that in 1908, the Royal Library of Baroda, which is in central India, they were going through a bunch of the old manuscripts in there, and some of them were 2,000 years old, and they found a book, and that book is called the Vimanika Shastra, and it was written by a guy named Maharishi Bharadwaja, and he wrote this 2,000 years ago, and he said right in his book that he was compiling this from earlier books that were many, many thousands of years older than this, and that this book, the Vimanika Shastra, was an entire book, George, that was all about Vimanas.
Wow.
So here was a book that wasn't just passingly mentioning these aerial ships of ancient India, but was just all about it in great detail. And in fact, it says that there were four types of Vimana, the Rukma Vimana, the Tripura Vimana, the Shakuna Vimana, And the, let's see, there was the Sundara Vimana was the fourth one. Some of these Vimanas, as they were described, were had wings and were apparently like an airplane. Others were long cigar-shaped Zeppelin-type craft. Another type was apparently kind of like a helicopter. And the fourth type of Vimana was a discoid flying saucer-type craft. And all four are described in detail. They talk about metals. They even talk about electricity. They talk about it. I mean, this is ancient Sanskrit, too. There were, you know, and the, these modern Sanskrit scholars are trying to figure this out. There were no actual drawings or anything in this document, but the early Sanskrit scholars, this was 1908 that all this was found, right at the dawn of our own era of flight. And then these Sanskrit scholars, and then some of these illustrations are in my book on Atlantis, Power System of the Gods, and another book, too, the Vimana Aircraft of Ancient Indian Atlantis. That book of mine includes the entire Vimanika Shastra. I mean, this entire ancient book on flight is in my book. They talk about aerial warfare, George. They talk about special, like, holographic projections to, even stuff that's like out of Star Wars or something, where your plane is actually projecting itself forward as a holograph, you know, to the left or the right, so that other enemy planes don't see you. They see this holographic projection. This is in the Vimanika Shastra.
Almost like they're cloaked, like they see in the Star Trek.
Stuff like that. I mean, when you read all this, you can't believe that there was even a book that would discuss all this, these Vimanas. One of the things that is talked about in the Vimanika Shastra about these ancient craft is that they use mercury, which is a strange thing. And this is what Bill Clendenin, in the beginning of my book, Atlantis and the Power System of the Gods, was deciphering. And I have to really give him credit for this, where he was fascinated, like myself, in the whole thing of Vimanas, the Vimanika Shastra. I mean, could we make sense out of what they were saying in this ancient book? And many people, this book is famous, and it's discussed not just in my books, but in all kinds of books about, you know, UFOs and mysteries of the past, because this thing is, it's baffling. What Bill came up with was that mercury is really an amazing element. Mercury is a metal, it's a conductor, it is an element. There's things you can do with mercury that you just can't do with other metals and elements. And one of the things you can do is make what Bill called mercury plasma gyros. So, now, at Adventures Unlimited, the publishing company that publishes and distributes a lot of the books that I do, and other people's as well, We've come out with these books on mercury, on anti-gravity, on gyros, and it's been shown that gyroscopes have an anti-gravity effect. And even like Joseph Newman, the famous free energy researcher out of Mississippi, right? And he once went on the Johnny Carson show back in the early 80s, and he was trying to explain his free energy concepts to Johnny Carson and stuff. And what he did was, on that show, was he brought with him a gyroscope.
I remember that.
And he put his gyroscope up, and, you know, Johnny Carson's tapping his pencil on the desk and everything, and Joe Newman was trying to explain these free energy concepts with his gyro. Gyros are amazing, and even though you can go to a toy store, buy a gyro, but scientists, you know, study these things.
I've never been able to get a gyro to fly.
Well, that is right. That's where these mercury vortex generators come in. In other words, there's a type of a gyro that you can construct, although for the layman, it would be difficult to construct this. It would have mercury. It's in a closed system. Mercury vapor is highly toxic, and mercury is deadly to work with this way. You cannot have any fumes or things coming out. But when you have mercury in a gyroscopic effect, and say mercury is whirling around, and it's a liquid, and it's a metal, it's also a conductor, what you can then do is you can add electricity to this gyroscopic moving mercury and electrify it. Now, when you electrify mercury in that way, it becomes what's called a plasma, an electrified gas. This same thing like a neon light or something. That's a plasma, too. That's an electrified gas.
I understand that.
All right. Now, when you have an electrified gas, a plasma that is circulating in a like a vortex movement, like a gyro, and part of this, too, is this effect that we're talking about is what's called, in physics, toroids. Toroids are...
Well, do you remember the movie Contact? In the Jodie Foster.
Jodie Foster and all that.
She's up in that machine that is spinning like crazy. Was that a gyro? I think it was.
Yeah, right. I remember that. Yeah, she's spinning around. Right, exactly.
Okay.
Something like that. And vortex motion and toroid motion and gyroscopic effect. I mean, the whole idea of tornadoes as something to look at. Even the whirling vortex at the bottom of your sink or bathtub or something, all that kind of stuff. There's today particularly in physics this whole thing of vortex technology, of vortex movement, toroidal movement, and then the idea of an electrified gas with mercury doing this. I've even taken this whole concept and Bill Clendenin's drawings, which Atlantis and the Power System of the Gods is profusely illustrated with a lot of technical drawings too. And I've shown these to physicists, one in particular, Maury B. King, who's a well-known physicist in Utah. He's well-respected. He's interested in these unusual energy topics. And he confirmed to me, he said, this is what Bill is saying here with these mercury vortex generators, these so-called mercury proton gyros with the electrified gas, he said that's a sound idea of an anti-gravity lift, of being able to create like a flying saucer type of craft that used a number of these things, like big ones and small ones for steering. You know, an interesting effect that you would have from these electrified mercury gyros that Bill and I talk about in the book is that when you electrify this gas, the mercury, and it becomes this plasma, it's a terrifically bright light. And so there's what's interesting, too, is when you look at some UFO phenomenon and descriptions of people who've been around, and, you know, I believe that there's no one answer myself for the UFO phenomenon. I think there's a myriad of them. But I think that some UFOs are these mercury plasma craft. Some may be built, you know, recently, perhaps like an Area 51 by our government or something. Other governments, I think, ultra research these things. But some may be even ancient craft. And I argue this in my books, too, on Atlantis, the Power System of the Gods, the Vimon aircraft.
Well,
and
these crafts, though, David, in those days, assuming they existed, did they create them or were they given them by someone else?
Okay, right. Well, that's a good question. And what I do want to say, though, just before I answer that question, is that with UFO phenomenon, the idea of these spinning and bright lights, and that people would witness these flying saucer craft, and they would say they're these rotating, brilliant lights and colored lights rotating around the craft and stuff. And that is what these mercury gyros would do. You would have that kind of a bright light circulating. Well, now, as to... was it like extraterrestrials gave us this technology? Certainly extraterrestrials would have this technology. I believe that there are extraterrestrial craft who monitor this planet, who come here. I believe the moon, in fact, is a base that they're using. And I have a whole book about that called Extraterrestrial Archaeology, which is all about the moon and stuff. But according to really...
And so one place you haven't visited yet, but I'm sure you'll get there.
I'm on my way. Yeah, I'm trying to build my own rocket, actually, to go up there, yeah. The Russians aren't taking, you know... if I had the $20 million, I don't know if they'd launch me all the way to the moon. I'm a believer myself, and I tend to argue this in my books, like Technology of the Gods and Atlantis and the Power System of the Gods, that this stuff is more or less man-made, that it's not just given to us by extraterrestrials. They, of course, have this technology, know all about it, and much more. And I believe, too, that as spiritual beings, that as we grow and we understand the universe better, and I mean, that means quantum physics and hyperspace and exactly how the universe works from the smallest atomic structure up to the way the galaxies and the whole universe spins around. By the way, there you also see this vortex movement as well. You know, look at a galaxy in space. I mean, it's also this spinning vortex wheel, like a kind of tornado, slowly spinning on the galactic core or whatever.
What I don't understand, David, is I always have thought of technology, be it current or ancient, that if you had the ability to build these crafts, where are your computers? Where are your radios? Where are your TV sets? Where is all that? Or maybe it's not necessary. Maybe I'm looking at technology as we are today, and maybe back 1,000 or 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago, you didn't need all those extras.
Well, those are good questions, of course, George. And, you know, I think the whole thing is how we look at the past. And by the way, I think that these craft, in fact, are probably 10,000 years old, if they still exist, and that it was back then. It's quite possible, I think, that if craft like this existed, I mean, we're talking about the time of Atlantis, which I maintain is, say, 10,000 BC and
mm-hmm.
earlier.
Mm-hmm.
At a time like a number of people whom I'm also friends with, from Graham Hancock to Christopher Don of the Giza Power Plant and guys like Stephen Mailer. You know, we believe that John Anthony West, to a point, who also believes that, like, the Sphinx is over 10,000 years old, that there are structures in Egypt that are essentially pre-Egyptian, like the Osirion, which is in southern Egypt, or the Valley
right.
Temple. So, yeah, I mean, I'm saying that this stuff is 10,000 years old and built to last.
How would you love to find one of those on one of your trips?
Oh, that would be great. And I think that really that there is an electronics behind it, and there are nuts and bolts kind of computers, but not exactly the kind we use today, more like using crystals like we use CDs.
All right, let's get into the next hour, David, the power sources there, and really get into Atlantis as well, because he brings up in his book, Atlantis and the Power System of the Gods, a very, very interesting subject. And let's talk about that next hour. I'm George Norrie. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you here with my guest, David Hatcher Childress. David, off the coast of Cuba, they have found in 2,000 feet of water what could be a very ancient civilization. They are seeing towers and buildings. Do you think possibly that could be where Atlantis is?
You know, I think that that's a very good possible location, and that's a very exciting discovery. And we provide some of the sonar photos that came out of that submarine research in our magazine there, World Explorer.
Did you? Okay.
Yeah, and this submarine, 2,000 feet underwater. And, they're saying that there's a Cuban, Canadian research team. They're spending literally millions of dollars doing this. And what they say they see down there, this is off the west coast of Cuba, going towards the Yucatan, there are these pyramids, streets. I mean, the city's laid out on a grid. Wouldn't surprise me if there were some obelisks or something there, although they probably would have fallen over by now, I would think. But this is, it's the kind of thing that definitely fits into the legend of Atlantis.
You're a believer in Edgar Cayce, as I am, and, of course, he was always a believer in Atlantis. And I think, you know, if I were a betting man, I would say that I think the myths are true. I think Atlantis was real. Something happened to it. I don't know what. What would be your take on that? What do you think happened to the place?
Well, you know what? I also, like you, more or less go along with what Edgar Cayce says, and I'm much of a believer in that. I mean, to me, really, Atlantis is the search for advanced civilizations that go back 10,000 years or more. And you can call them whatever you want, but, you know, Atlantis is the popular term. And Cayce, too, said that the real name for Atlantis was Poseid, which gets into also the ancient Greek term and god Poseidon.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, you know, and it's not that Atlantis, too, is just some little city and it's off Cuba or it has to be in one little place. There was supposedly a capital city of Atlantis, and it was this huge, massive city with concentric canals and ports of and bridges that ultimately went into a central pyramid city that was all part of this giant capital of Atlantis. But that doesn't mean that Atlantis can't be, in a sense, all over the world, and that evidence for Atlantis and, like, in a sense, colonies of Atlantis and other areas that were connected. I mean, I believe, and Casey basically maintained this too, that Atlantis was a worldwide civilization, much in the same way that, like, English civilization is worldwide today. I mean, imagine if 200 years ago, or 200 or 300 years in the future, I should say, archaeologists are excavating some destroyed continent in the South Pacific used to be called Australia, and they're excavating this giant city down there named Sydney, and then they suddenly say, hey, you know, our archaeologists are coming to the conclusion that this weird ancient city is connected to this island on the other side of the world. It's this tiny island up in the North Sea, and it used to be called Britain, and there used to be another city there called London, and this city called Sydney is, you know, somehow connected to that. Well, I mean, they're completely on the other side of the world. I mean, you couldn't get as far away from Sydney, Australia as London, in a way. And yet, you know, that of course would be a correct assumption that England and Australia were, in fact, very much closely linked.
Well, what do you think happened to it? Earthquake? Asteroid? Do you think they blew themselves up?
Well, you know, that's one of the stories, too, that the Atlanteans had a part to play in their own destruction, which may have been playing with certain kinds of terrific power, the whole idea of these terrible crystal towers that Edgar Cayce talked about. I'm a believer myself in what are called pole shifts. And again, in science, there's often these schisms and poles apart. In geology, there's a similar thing, too, where you have what is called uniformitarian geology, which is what we're all taught today in school generally, that geological change is very slow. Continents, you know, sort of drift and continental drift, you know, for millions of years, you know, one way or another, and mountains slowly inch their way up over millions of years, getting bigger or something.
Mm-hmm.
Cataclysmic geology is just the opposite, where geological change is very rapid, and suddenly, even though there's slow geological change, every once in a while the Earth goes berserk, and the Earth's ripped asunder, and there are giant tidal waves, huge tsunamis, volcanoes go off, and, I mean, huge, huge earthquakes where tectonic plates are plunged up and down, and it's not just a matter of, you know, sea levels rising a couple of hundred feet, because that wouldn't explain, like, this sunken city off Cuba that's 2,000 feet deep. They're saying now that, at the end of the last ice age, which is one of the big mysteries, too, these ice ages, well, that ocean levels were 300 feet lower than they are today.
Yeah.
So if you had civilizations, you know, going back over 10,000 years, civilizations, and, I mean, if you want to find the lost cities of some continent, well, look at the river systems, because rivers, even today in the era of flight, major cities are still usually near major rivers. And, in fact, major cities are particularly where rivers come to the ocean. Now, if over 10,000 years ago you were building cities where rivers came to the ocean, according to mainstream geology, those, you know, tributaries that are meeting the ocean, they're 300 feet underwater now. 300 feet. I mean, you couldn't even scuba dive down to those locations. You'd have to take a submarine. Now, so all over the world, if there were civilizations over 10,000 years ago, that city's civilization, those major port cities, the ones that were all near the ocean, are going to be at least 300 feet underwater. But that doesn't explain, again, how a city like in Cuba can be 2,000 feet underwater.
Do you imagine if that plummeted in an instant, the whole thing, 2,000 feet of a landmass just sinking like that? Because I don't think this went gradually. I think this thing just went boom and down it went.
That's like the tectonic plate theory, where you have these continental plates, and some of them are underwater, like the Pacific plate is there. It's a giant continental plate, but it's mainly underwater. These things can move up and down, depending, on what's happening in the world and the kind of forces that are being, stressful forces being put on the Earth's crust. Now here's where pole shifts come in. The whole, it's interesting idea too that all the ivory that was found and all these that was used for piano keys and billiard balls back in the 1800s, that ivory didn't come from African elephants. That ivory came from mountains. Piles of ivory and bones that's found in Alaska and Siberia, and it's from these herds of animals that were just swept up in these huge tidal waves, pulverized, and then washed into these mountains of broken bone and ivory, and literally millions of dollars of ivory just washed around on these islands in Alaska and Siberia.
What about the biblical flood? Is that possible?
Stuff like that, right. So the idea of a pole shift is this, that as the Earth's crust is on a very slippery mantle of magma, I sometimes make an analogy to taking a raw egg and putting it on a table and then spinning it. Then reach out and just stop that spinning egg for a moment. Then take your hand away. What will happen? The egg will start to spin again because you've only stopped that thin crust and the inner core of the egg is still spinning. Now this is kind of what's happening with the Earth, is allegedly in the pole shift scenario, and this has been proposed by a number of people like Charles Hapgood, who wrote Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings. He also wrote Path of the Pole. Even Einstein proposed also and was a believer in these pole shifts. He wrote the introduction to Hapgood's book on Path of the Pole. The idea that what happens is ice builds up at the poles, and it can also have to do with like the Jupiter effect and planetary alignments. But as the Earth becomes unstable, what happens is the Earth's core maintains its normal rotation, but the thin crust of the Earth like flips in space and moves forward. And what was like the North Pole and all this ice, it slips, say, 20 degrees one direction. And the Earth's crust rips, according to Hapgood, when this happens, because of the bulge of the Earth. The Earth's not perfectly round, and it's wider at the equators. According to Hapgood and James Churchward, who wrote those Lost Continent of Mu books back in the 30s, he also was a proponent of these pole shifts, how the Earth literally flips in space. And then when this happens, oceans spill out of their basins and wash over continents. All the volcanoes in the world would go off. There are massive, massive earthquakes at all the rift zones around the planet. It's cataclysmic. But it's not the end of the world, although to many people it is. It causes mass extinctions. These like giant herds of woolly mammoths and woolly rhinos are suddenly washed up into giant piles of ivory. Other woolly mammoths that are in a fairly warm temperate zone and they're sitting there eating buttercups suddenly find them flash frozen
near
to the North Pole. And they freeze with like food still in their mouth while they're chewing and everything.
Exactly. I know. It's just amazing that they would freeze that quickly.
Yeah, this is part of the whole enigma of the flash frozen mammoths. You can even go to Moscow to these special restaurants and have a mammoth steak that's 10,000 years old.
I bet it's tough.
While we're thinking of mammoths,
then again, that's what I call aged meat, huh?
That's right. Back then they didn't have those Japanese masseurs to sort of hand massage these mammoths, you know.
Exactly.
Like Kobe beef or something. But, you know, the world back then was a different world, but there were people just like us. But it was a world where everything was bigger, and animals were bigger, and there were cave bears and giant saber-toothed tigers, and I believe there were dragons back then, you know, still giant lizards and stuff roaming around. And I mean, some of these things are still alive today, although woolly mammoths are extinct, and this was what caused their extinction.
Well, David, let me ask you about Atlantis for a moment. I want you to paint a picture, and this is all in your head, but I want to see what it looks like. Tell me what you think Atlantis looked like 10,000 years ago. I mean, just kind of describe it as if you and I and everyone who's listening right now were kind of flying in on an airplane, landing out there in Atlantis somewhere. What do we see?
Okay, well, you would be coming in. This is the classic description from Plato, by the way, in his two books, the Critias and the Timaeus, which he says comes from ancient Egyptian priests. You'd be flying over the water, over the Atlantic. Plato and the Egyptians say it was out in the Atlantic. And you'd be flying out over, and then suddenly you would see this giant island with a huge mountain. Very, very high, with snow-capped peak, like Mount Fuji or something, coming up and would be there in the distance. And as you approached the coast of Atlantis, you would start seeing huge, massive port facilities and giant stone walls. You would see canals and locks that go now into the interior of Atlantis, and a broad, flat plain that comes out from the base of this mountain. And then as you flew out over these giant canals and locks, you would see more and more of these huge earthworks and megalithic constructions that were basically these concentric circles of land mixed with huge canals. And you would be seeing all these giant ships, much like the huge Phoenician and Roman triremes.
Wow.
You would probably see huge obelisks. In the center of Atlantis was a massive pyramid structure called the Enkaliphon, and in it was also a giant light that shone down. In many ways, this beam of light was said to be coming straight up out of this pyramid. This is very similar to the Christopher Dunn's Giza power plant theory. So this is more or less what Edgar Cayce and Plato and the Egyptians described Atlantis.
Would we see, David, little flying machines all over the place?
Well, you would see these flying machines. They would be, according to Edgar Cayce and another obscure group out of California called the Lemurian Fellowship, maintained a very similar thing, that there were these airships. These airships were real similar to like Zeppelin type cigar craft. This is what Cayce talked about. He said that they drew power from these crystal towers, that these crystal towers were radiating power very much like the Nikola Tesla system, that these airships would use them as a directional homing beacon kind of a thing.
That was almost like it was wireless power, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, that's what Cayce was talking about in the Lemurian Fellowship, that power was being broadcast into the atmosphere, and that these airships could draw power from this pulsed power. And, I mean, this is key, really, to my book, Atlantis and the Power System of the Gods, because, really, what I found with the Edgar Cayce system was that it was virtually identical to the system that Nikola Tesla was trying to set up in 1915, essentially. And that was his Wardenclyffe Power Tower that J.P. Morgan had been financing. And it was very similar to what Cayce was talking about, of these terrible crystals, these crystal towers that pumped power into the atmosphere, much like a radio station. It's pumping power out there, much like a television station.
Okay, and if you had this kind of electrical receiver on whatever apparatus you had, you'd be able to draw on that power?
Well, that was the right, exactly. And, I mean, this was Tesla's incredible system that he was trying to set up. I mean, this guy is probably the greatest inventor who ever lived, but most people have never even heard of him. He literally invented the alternating current system that we're using today, and then went on to try and do other experiments that are today, you know, considered practically science fiction. And that was to take these power towers, pump power into the atmosphere, and then appliances wouldn't have to be plugged into an outlet, and we wouldn't have this high-tension wire grid like we have today. In other words, if you had like a lamp or something and you wanted to plug it in, you wouldn't have to like have a cable and then plug it into the wall.
Yeah, you wouldn't need an outlet at all.
You wouldn't need an outlet. That's right. I mean, you could put a lamp anywhere you wanted into your house, and part of it would just ground itself to the ground, and it would work. Your toaster, any kind of appliance could work like this.
Wow.
So, I mean, and this was what Tesla was trying to set up. J.P. Morgan, the great financier, was even financing this whole thing, and they almost completed the first tower in this whole system in Long Island, right near Montauk Point, in fact. So, but then what happened was J.P. Morgan decided, well, he didn't want to create a system that basically was giving free electricity to people, and then they would have to buy his lamps and appliances. I mean, that's what he would have had to have done, was become like General Electric did, in a sense, you know, become this
big appliance manufacturer. Giving away the razor to sell the blades, right?
Yeah, right. So what happened was, in the end, was that J.P. Morgan, he pulled all the funding for this you know, wireless power system that Tesla was trying to create. And Tesla was was very much a dreamer. He was a tremendous visionary. I'm a believer that he was literally a reincarnated Atlantean scientist who had come back to the world right when he did to bring this incredible technology to us. I mean, right now, in every one of your listeners' homes, they're using his inventions, and it's mind-blowing what he did, and yet today it's just our everyday life.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the fact that maybe he was reincarnated from someone from Atlantis. Maybe he was working on those ancient towers on that lost continent. Stay with me. I'm George Norrie. My guest is David Hatcher Childress, and we are talking about his fascinating book, Atlantis and the Power System of the Gods. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. This is Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. David Hatcher Childress, my guest. David, let's talk a little bit about the power source out there that you believe could have been in Atlantis. I think it's fantastic. I mean, free energy like that beamed up into the atmosphere where anybody could use it. How do you think they, 10,000 years ago, were able to develop this? I mean, once again, I keep coming back to, was there help from above, or did we really have advanced civilizations, and maybe we're not smart enough today to realize that?
Well, that's more or less what I say. It's the way we look at the past. I mean, we've been basically taught that people who have lived and look just exactly like us, only taller and with bigger brains, Homo sapiens, Cro-Magnon man, have been around for over 100,000 years. I mean, this is us, our ancestors, only, you know, we were like a foot taller or something back then. But at the same time, they're saying, yeah, for 100,000 years, even though we had the same capacity to think and be curious and be inventive and all that stuff, no, we never did anything. And we just sat in our caves and munched on our barbecued, mammoth spare ribs and didn't do anything, you know. And then, but then, one day, 7,000-8,000 years ago in Sumeria or Egypt or India, wherever they say now civilization started, it changes all the time. It used to be in Sumeria. Now they say that's not the case. But, suddenly we just stepped out of our caves 7,000 years ago and started building ziggurats and giant pyramids and all these constructions. Well, all right, that's mainstream science, but it doesn't really make that much sense. And in fact, the evidence is there that people should have started making civilization, building boats, building walls and cities, irrigation plans, even modern plumbing, working with metals, and just trying to discover the secrets of the universe. So did that start only 7,000 years ago, or did it start 70,000 years ago?
Well, that's right. Do you remember the ending of the first Planet of the Apes when they stumble across the Statue of Liberty buried in the sands? I'm wondering if it's possible, like you say, maybe not 70,000 years ago, David. Maybe what if it was a million years ago or 2 million years ago?
Well, right. I mean, you get guys like, say, Michael Cremo, who wrote Forbidden Archaeology and stuff like that. I mean, that's the kind of thing that those guys maintain, that humans have been, and civilization has been on this planet for millions of years. And, you know, I'm not so convinced of that myself. But I do believe that there is pretty much a semi-contiguous civilization that has been going on here for at least 50,000 years. But it's been interrupted by these cataclysms, by man-made wars, by natural disasters, by these pole shifts. And, I mean, ultimately, in the end, it comes down to sort of mankind in amnesia. We don't remember our past, although at the same time, I mean, you know, we have almost every written record, like the Bible, which talks about not just one flood, but two. And cataclysms, the Hopis and the Aztecs and the Mayans all talked about the destruction of not just one world before us, but of four or even five, as with the Mayans.
Yeah, I've got to ask you about the Mayan calendar before we get into phone calls next hour, so remind me of that, if you would. Why is it with this power source that crystals are important?
Well, right, and Casey talked about these crystals and these terrible crystals. Now, it's something that you were asking me earlier, George, too, about. And I think this is what a lot of people naturally want to know. And it's like, well, okay, if these people had advanced technology, I mean, did they have computers? Did they have TVs? I mean, did they have, like, complicated machines and stuff just like we have? I mean, hey, a stealth fighter isn't, you know, just something you make in your garage, you know.
And why were they just walking around in robes?
People dressed funny back then, and just like today, you know, you go to modern India, I should say, and, you know, they build all their own jet fighters and stuff now as well. But, you know, those same guy, I mean, sure, some general in the Indian Army still wears, you know, like a green button-up uniform, but a lot of those guys and their wives are running around in what we would call pretty goofy-looking clothes.
Yeah.
You know, with pointed shoes and all these sequins, and the women, you know, just throw these silks around them and stuff like that and show their belly buttons. But that's how they're modern people who are physicists and electrical engineers, just like we are, but they don't wear, you know, the same black ties that we do. So look, I mean, how people dressed and stuff doesn't matter that much. Although, you know, I mean, having a bunch of, like, Sumerian guys in their sandals and swords jumping out of their rocket ships.
That's what I mean.
You know, right.
It's
no,
bizarre.
That doesn't make sense. I agree. And it wasn't really like that. I mean, Sumerian guys, like, you know, like some authors write about that along those ways. I don't think those guys were flying around, and rockets weren't what these people had anyway. But here's kind of the point, and it gets back to crystals and stuff like that. You know, particularly when it comes to machines and metals, they just won't last. The only real thing that's indestructible along those lines is gold. Gold is indestructible, and all the gold of ancient times, and gold that existed over 10,000 years ago, it still exists today in forms of jewelry and coins. You can't really destroy gold. It won't rust or oxidize, but that's not what normally happens to metals, and gold is too soft to really be practical in machines. You have to use, at the very least, some kind of a gold alloy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the harder kind of metals, like steel and bronze and things like that, they're going to rust, they're going to decay. I mean, if American civilization just somehow, you know, came to a sudden halt and nobody existed on this continent, the Golden Gate Bridge wouldn't be there in 10,000 years. It wouldn't even last 1,000 years.
It would just crumble to
it
nothing.
It would crumble and rust away, and it would be gone. And you know what? The Rolls Royce that you parked in your garage, it would also, it would just rust away and be gone.
There's no Rolls in my garage, trust me.
So, I mean, this is what I mean, is that we're not going to have those kind of machines. I worked for an oil company back in the late 70s in southern Sudan, and I used to drive this Land Rover around these remote swamps and deserts there. And it was well known to me that if my Land Rover would break down and I left it there and I came back in a week, it wouldn't be there. And not because it would have rusted away, because the first person who came along with that, they wouldn't have driven it away. They would have literally stripped that Land Rover down into little, you know, pieces of metal and then made them into spears and swords and shields. I watched it happen right there at these very crude, you know, forges in there in the middle of Africa.
Well, why did Edgar Cayce call these crystals terrible?
Okay, well, so these crystals, you've got these, with him, these were these terrible, these giant crystals, okay? And crystals themselves, quartz crystals, they are like natural computer chips. A little bit like in the Superman, when Superman goes to his Fortress of Solitude, which is up near the North Pole or something like that, and what he's using to store all this information from his own home planet are these giant crystals. And he takes these huge quartz crystals, and in fact, the purer the quartz crystal, the better. They are like mini, giant computer chips. If you took a good quartz crystal, you could, just like a DVD or a CD, you can use a laser and you can encode, you know, every encyclopedia in the world, all in like one quartz crystal.
God, well, how do you retrieve it?
Well, the same way. You would have
a reader.
Yeah,
I guess
you have a reader, and which would also use a laser to shine into it. Now, my point there is that, yeah, I think that over 10,000 years ago and in Atlantis and ancient India and these advanced ancient civilizations that I propose and believe in, they did have what we would call computer technology. They probably had liquid crystal displays. They had metals. They had bolts and screws. They had, electrical devices and motors, very similar to ones we had today.
Batteries
and stuff like that, absolutely. You know, I'm on my way, actually, in a couple of weeks to New Guinea, and I've been there before. New Guinea is a bizarre island where 747 jets, you know, arrive, you know, from Sydney, and they land at an international airport in Port Moresby in New Guinea. And the people in New Guinea, they see these things land. They don't know how to make an airplane. They don't know how to fly one. They'll never, ever make an airplane in New Guinea, I can tell you that.
Yeah,
it's just not like that. But yet, you know, the modern world full of 747s and modern manufacturing plants that even make these things is not very far from New Guinea. It's just, you know, a few hundred miles across the ocean in Australia. They're making all this stuff. But in New Guinea, it's like coming from another planet.
Okay, here's the thing. Why did Edgar Cayce call these crystals terrible? What did they do that was so bad?
Okay, well, yeah, with Cayce's terrible crystal, what he claimed were these huge towers, and the Lemurian Fellowship said the same thing, that they were these massive crystal towers, very similar, identical, I believe, to the obelisks that we're familiar with in Egypt today. And obelisks are massive, monolithic granite structures, and granite is a crystal, a crystalline rock, and it can be tuned. I mean, this is all part of the thing, and the Tesla technology that we were talking about earlier, how these giant granite towers are cut to a certain size and dimension. They have a resonant tone. And then, in theory, they would have been hooked up to a massive electrical power plant. Something has to be generating electricity, like a hydroelectric plant.
Okay, sure.
Tesla had built the first one, actually, at Niagara Falls, and that power plant still exists today. In Egypt, say the Nile, it happens to be that right around where the granite quarry for the obelisks, which is at Aswan, is also where the waterfalls on the Nile begin as well.
Well, were the obelisks transmitters?
Well, the obelisks were the transmitters. They were what I maintain in my book, Atlantis and the Power System of the Gods, is that the obelisks were the transmitting towers like Tesla's Wardenclyffe Tower that he was building on Long Island. And that just like his tower, and he had gone to Colorado Springs in the late 1800s to do his experiments and build his early prototype towers there. But, yeah, that these obelisks would then be hooked up to these transmitting stations. They were the transmitters. They were the terrible crystal of Edgar Cayce. They were transmitting this power, these what Tesla called longitudinal waves and transverse longitudinal waves. It's a certain kind of a power that was pulsed into the atmosphere. In theory, you would have had a network of these towers, so you couldn't just have one of these obelisks, these giant crystals. You would have had like a special grid. They would have been all over the world. They would have been in Egypt. They would have been in Atlantis. There are giant obelisks in Ethiopia. You know, as I started getting into my book, George, and I've been to Egypt quite a few times. I was there just last year, in fact. And I began researching obelisks and just mainstream archaeology. Well, what do Egyptologists say that these obelisks are for anyway? I mean, why did the Egyptians go through this tremendous effort to erect these huge monolithic, you know, crystal towers, these obelisks? I mean, they weigh 100 tons or 200 tons each.
How tall are they?
Just trying to stand them up is a problem for Egyptologists. They can't really figure out how the Egyptians did it.
They're a couple hundred feet tall? At least, huh?
That's right. Right, they're huge. I mean, when you see some of the ones that are still standing in Egypt, I mean, they're amazing. Now, you know what mainstream Egyptologists say that I found out as I researched, and it's hard to find books about obelisks. There are not very many, and some of the ones I have, I bought in Egypt. I don't think you could get them in this country. But, I mean, it was kind of strange because Egyptologists, I found, didn't have a really good explanation for obelisks. Well, they supposedly represent the sun. Well, they supposedly are a ray of the sun. Well, you know, supposedly they just loved having obelisks, these giant, you know, towers in front of their temples. And, you know, for no special reason except that, they thought that the ray of the sun looked like some giant, you know, granite pillar that was 200 feet high. I found out there that there was no real clear reason why the Egyptians were into obelisks, and it became clear to me that perhaps they worshipped obelisks because they were remnants of this previous civilization, basically, and had been part of what Cayce had talked about, this Tesla-like power system that was literally worldwide, put power into the atmosphere. Airships drew power, like Tesla had said they would, from his towers. And they could use it for guidance, too, and they would home in as they travel from continent to continent. So in my book, you know, I give a bunch of Tesla readings and Edgar Cayce readings where he talks about exactly all these towers and people's past lives in Atlantis.
What the heck happens, David, if you're flying around and for some reason the power thing went out? I mean, down you go or what?
Well, I mean, that's why it was a system of a number of towers, and there wasn't just one. So you would have had, in theory, hundreds of these towers pumping power into the atmosphere, and so any one tower going down wouldn't stop you. But eventually, with the cataclysm that destroyed Atlantis, this pole shift, circa 10,000 BC, I mean, that did bring this power system down, and you know, areas that were above water, like Atlantis, were suddenly underwater.
And maybe it blew up.
Well, right. And, the power systems, the power plants that were still above water stopped functioning. The world essentially reverted back to a kind of a stone age. And, we had, I mean, people went into a survival mode.
They probably could have used it as a heating source, too, you know, to keep their houses.
Radiant, yeah, exactly. You know? Radiant kind of heat. I mean, here's what we need to really keep in mind. Energy is all around us. We swim through a sea of energy just walking across a room. There's no such thing as you know, a vacuum of space where we are. There's potential energy in just a square meter of atmosphere. And as Tesla said, too, is that there's a differential between the Earth, the surface of the Earth, and anywhere above the Earth in the atmosphere. And the higher you go, and that's why you need these towers, is that that as you go just up a couple of hundred feet, and the higher you can go, you create a differential, and that itself creates a power circuit that you can amplify.
That's exciting. You remember when we were kids, they always used to think that there was some kind of sunken crystal near the Bermuda Triangle? What do you think that was?
Yeah, right. Well, I was just going to mention that, too, that, I mean, that's one of the interesting theories on the Bermuda Triangle, is that there is a giant pyramid or crystal or one of these power towers, like crystal towers, is in the Bermuda Triangle, and every once in a while it becomes activated, you know, just by time and space, where the Earth is at a certain time or something, and starts creating these dimensional anomalies, and creating some of these famous weird effects that the Bermuda Triangle is known for. I think that's a great theory, and if that could be proven, I would like to see that.
If they ever stumble across that. Well, for the next 2 hours now, it's your turn. We're going to open up the phone lines so that you may become part of the program, so that you can talk with David Hatcher Childress about what we have been talking about. And, of course, I have not forgotten the Mayan calendar. I'll ask you that, David, right after we come back. I'm George Norrie. Don't touch your dial. Get ready to make your phone calls. You're listening to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM with my guest, David Hatcher Childress. David, before we go to the calls, the many calls, let me ask you about the Mayan calendar. It ends 2012. Your interpretation of that, what does that mean?
Well, right. December 22nd, 2012 is the end of the Mayan calendar, and that will really be the end of the fifth world, according to the Mayans. They believe that the end of every calendar, which was thousands of years, like 4,600 years or something like that, would be these cataclysms. And one time the Earth was destroyed in fire. Another time the Earth was destroyed by ice. Another time the Earth was destroyed by water. So, I mean, the whole idea that there are these periodical cataclysms, they have to do, according to Hapgood, they have to do with ice building up at the poles, one or both of the poles. And also planetary alignments and other factors as well. Right now, I mean, they're saying that, we've had the mildest winter. We're going through all this weird climatic change.
Strange, very strange weather.
I mean, certainly a lot of people would say that, these are signs that we're coming to the end of an age. Even in Western tradition, this is now the beginning of the Aquarian Age and the end of the Piscean Age. And the idea that there should be all this upheavals, including, you know, just psychological and personal as well as physical on the planet as well. And all this can be leading up to the year 2012. I mean, I believe, too, that you know, that history and the planet, it's a cyclical thing. What's happened in the past is happening now and will happen in the future. We keep kind of repeating the same mistakes. Like King Solomon said, there's nothing new under the sun. And this allegedly, you know, that's part of what we're here to do. We're here to learn. We're here to kind of keep doing the same things over and over again until we get it right. And part of that, too, is living with each other in harmony, living with nature in harmony.
Well, do you think on that date, December 22nd, 2012, that's it? Is it going to be that abrupt? Or are we going to really see something as we lead up to it?
I think we would see signs. Whether there would be a pole shift at that date, I certainly look at all these things with a great deal of interest, just like you and most of your listeners too, I'm sure. I mean, I don't really have all the answers, but I think that it won't be just totally abrupt, that there will be plenty of signs and a lot of probably earthquakes and geological change and climatic change before the really big one happens.
Maybe time to prepare. Let's go to first-time caller in Worcester, Massachusetts. Jim, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi, Jim.
Hi, George. I'd like to...
Let me tell you a quick funny story first.
Oh, sure.
Because as a boy, my mother was born in Fitchburg, which is not too far from where you are, and my uncle owned a furniture company, and we used to deliver furniture in Worcester. And he made me carry this stuff off like three flights of stairs in your area. That's my little story of Worcester.
I used to do furniture moving up Cape Cod. Anyway, I'm calling from Worcester, and I'm listening through WTAG AM 580 here. And I have two questions. One is, has our guest, David Hatcher Childress, have you read... Atlantis Found by Clive Cussler? And number two, I would like to ask, I'd like to even say that a base down on Antarctica would not be an all much unfeasible thing, considering that we had an incredible billionaire by the an engineer, also a physician by the name of Armand Hammer, who was a miner, a great friend of Lenin, owned a dacha and a huge apartment inside and outside of Moscow, and had many, many mining innovations, including a thing called thermal cracking, or what they call heat tunneling, which was published in Popular Science quite a few years ago, about extracting oil from rock, which never came to fruition. Mm-hmm. But the technology could have been used to make a base down in Antarctica very, very quickly. Colorado School of the Mines could probably tell you more about than that. After this, I'll just listen to Mr. Childress.
Okay, very good. Atlantis Found. Did you ever read that book?
I did, and that's a great book. I love Clive Cussler books. And, in fact, if you look at the acknowledgments of that book, you will see that he references a lot of the authors that you'll find at Adventures Unlimited and on our web pages, including Charles Hapgood, who wrote Paths of the Pole and Maps of Ancient Sea Kings, and my friend Graham Hancock, another author of ours, too, Colonel Howard Buchner, who wrote about Antarctica and these secret Nazi bases and stuff down there. So, yeah, in fact, there's no doubt in my mind that Clive Cussler reads my books. And certainly, he acknowledges he reads Graham Hancock and Hapgood and Buchner and those guys, all of whom we sell and publish. So, he's great. And Dirk Pitts, probably, he's a great hero. That said, Armand Hammer too is, I'm familiar more or less with him and his sponsoring of the Soviets and the Russians. Yeah, they have, what are called flame jet tunnelers too, and, Colorado School of Mines, making bases in Antarctica, and they would be underground. The base at the South Pole is not in rock. It's the ice cap at the South Pole is over a mile thick, and the underground base there that's run jointly by the Russians and the Americans is essentially a under ice base, and there is another interesting thing that crops up, and perhaps it's, you guys have talked about in Art Bell, is this Lake Vostok, this weird under-ice lake that's also not frozen, and it's got fish and stuff in it, and there's a Soviet base right there.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, weird rumors of also like an under-ice city there. People like Rand Flamath and Graham Hancock also kind of jumped on this bandwagon of Flamath basically proposed that Antarctica was underneath the ice in Antarctica. And he used Hapgood's maps, Age of Sea Kings, and Path of the Pole to come to his conclusions. And then Clive Cussler used that same idea for his Atlantis Found, where they find Atlantis underneath the ice. And there's also a Nazi base there. I get into that in my books on man-made UFOs and Buchner's books on the Holy Lands and stuff. So, yeah, I mean, the more you find out about Antarctica and Atlantis, and a lot of this stuff reaches us right today, and it's bizarre. As a matter of fact, a lot of the tension right now between India and Pakistan goes right back to the Rama Empire and the Ramayana and Vimanas and stuff like that, sure. What we were talking about. What has ignited a lot of the tension right now in India, aside from the stuff in Kashmir, has to do with these Hindu extremists who want to destroy this mosque that's built in Ayodhya. And this is a big, big deal in India, and it even gets into the mainstream news here, because what happens is every few years, and this happened again just recently, Hindus go to this town in northern India. It's called Ayodhya, where Rama was from, where he took his Vimana to fly and get his wife back. They go there, and they want to destroy this mosque that's built on this ancient Hindu temple that dedicated to Rama, and to these Hindus, this is the most sacred spot in all of India because it's where Rama lived and the temple to him is. But they have a problem, which is there's this Muslim mosque built there. So these Hindus want to destroy it. The Muslims, of course, are upset that these Hindus want to destroy this mosque. And all these riots, and I mean, hundreds of people have been killed in India just in the last few months over this. And it all goes back, incredibly, to this so-called ancient civilization of ancient India called the Rama Empire, where they had airships, where they had electricity, where they had all these massive weapons and stuff like that.
Hmm.
And it's all talked about in the ancient Indian epics.
Sounds like history's repeating itself again, David.
Wow, exactly. You're right. I mean, and in fact, there's evidence that there was a nuclear war in ancient India years ago. And I have a whole chapter of that in my book, Technology of the Gods.
Let's go to some more calls. Let's go to Wildcard Caller in Milton, Connecticut. Laura, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. Hi, it's Milford.
Milford. Okay.
M-I-L-L.
All right, great. Well, welcome to the show. Go ahead.
Okay. I have a couple really interesting things. I have a rare booklet on the apparition of the Blessed Mother in La Salette, France, which was 1846.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the exact translation. There's a few things that are very interesting. David's talking about, you know, the reversal of the poles and things like that. Just,
yes.
And there's certain parts, a little bit I just wanted to read. It says, let's talk about the end of the world and because of mankind, you know, has been, you know, used the earth and, well, anyway, it says, the seasons will be altered. The earth will produce nothing but bad fruit. The stars will lose their regular motion. The moon will only reflect a faint reddish glow. Water and fire will give the earth's globe convulsions and terrible earthquakes, which will swallow up mountains, cities, etc.
Yeah, that was written in the 1800s. Wow. See, David?
Yeah, right. And you know what? Descriptions like that are very common, and Edgar Cayce talked about stuff like that in Revelations, where they talk about Armageddon and opening the seals of the Armageddon and all that. And one of the first ones is a giant earthquake that, you know, renders the whole world asunder kind of thing.
Hey, as a modern Indiana Jones, are you too also looking for the Ark of the Covenant?
Well, right. And in fact, in my mind, the Ark of the Covenant is also one of these ancient relics that's relatively high-tech, although the Ark of the Covenant probably wasn't really a computer, I don't think, like as some of they would have had to have for some of these airships and stuff. But the Ark of the Covenant was like an electrical device. It was, read the Bible, I mean, it would shock people. Only special priests were allowed to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
There was a bunch of stuff, and part of the Ark of the Covenant was a box, and certain things were inside it. But, yeah, the whole idea that this light came out of it, I maintain that really what happened in the ancient world was that a lot of the technology that survived became part of the religions and things like that. The famous crystal skull, that the Mitchell Hedges skull that was supposedly found in Lubantum, that too was used in temples, and it had holes specially drilled in the base of it so that you could manipulate the skull and it would look like it was talking. So imagine, you know, in the ancient world, it's kind of like a Conan movie or something like that, where, you know, you walk into these giant temples and they're dark and everything, and huge, you know, magnificent buildings, and the priest takes you up to the altar, and then there's this glowing light that seems like magic. I mean, it's because there's electricity there, and you don't have electricity. It's only in this temple, and that we know that they did stuff like this. And then suddenly there's this, not only this light, but there's this glowing crystal skull, and the thing starts talking to you, and it's chattering, and its mouth is moving up and down, and the whole thing's glowing with this eerie light, and, you know, you are really impressed.
Great way to control the populace in those days,
exactly,
David.
That's exactly right, and as you leave the temple, the priest, you know, you're totally blown away. You've never seen anything like this before. And the priest says, you know, okay, well, just give generously on your way out, you know.
He says,
and
jump,
come back
and you
as
say
soon as you
how
can.
High. Yeah,
and,
exactly.
You know, and that's how it was. And the Ark of the Covenant was like that. I believe that the Ark of the Covenant is such an important relic that it's probably kept today by a secret society. And what is kept in Ethiopia today in one of the giant megalithic rock-cut temples there is, I believe, a replica of the Ark of the Covenant, although Graham Hancock and some others think that that's the real Ark of the Covenant. I don't think that.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Let's go out to Phoenix, Arizona. Dan, you're on the show on Coast to Coast. Hi.
Yeah, from what I understand, I read years ago, I think it was Populous Science, they showed where all the pole shifts have been. The original pole shift was almost a complete topsy-turvy. That is, the north went to the south, south went to the north. The next pole shifts all were shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. They know where the poles were by the lodestones or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this next shift of the poles will be one, the shortest one that they have so far. Now, during, from what I understand from Ed Casey's writings, that he said the northern, most of Japan would go below the waters, a western portion of America would, the west coast would be broken up. He mentioned some other things. And all these things were going to take place, apparently not all at once, because at the very end of his writings, he got to the point where he said, but the northern part of Europe would change within the twinkling of an eye, which meant the other things that he had talked about weren't that fast changing. Now, I'm a hypnotist, and I put under this gal under hypnosis, and she's very remarkable. She can remote view and do some wild things like this, and she has no idea what Art Bell's programs or any of these things are about. Under hypnosis, she sees coming suddenly out of the blue, she sees that the sun is coming up in a different position. Knowing what I know, and I didn't ask her, let her know anything, I said, well, then go to the northern part of Europe, up in there. What do you see? She says, well, it seems to have changed. It's foggy and snowing. And so I assumed that the pole had shifted to that point. Now, here's the kicker. She says, but they move it back in position again.
They? Who is they? Or
guess
who are
who?
They?
Guess who? The extraterrestrials.
Yeah.
Now, it's kind of wild that this gal knows absolutely
nothing. That's
pretty
fascinating.
That's pretty fascinating
stuff, Dan. I like
and,
that.
And the point of it is, this gal, they're only interested in makeup and hair and that type of thing. If you know what I mean. She knows nothing about, and I never clue her in on anything.
And, but she tells you all this under hypnosis.
Right.
And very interesting, yes, right.
She remote-viewed out to what's the name of that place off the Montauk Point?
Montauk.
Huh? Yeah, she told me that way below the ground, there's a big square building, and she says it's got like three or four what she said looks like flying saucers to her. That's about as far, you know. And I said, well, go into one. And she says, they won't let me. And same out in space. I sent her way out in space, and she's out between the Earth and the Moon and out there. And I said, now look around. And I said, do you see anything out there? Well, yeah, she saw something shiny. It looked like a bullet or something. So I said, go over close to it. Is there anybody, anything inside? Oh, yes. Yes, I can tell it's something inside. Well, go in and look. Long silence. And then she says, they won't let me. Because if she was dreaming us up, she'd dream all kinds of panels and everything else upside, but they just went. And then I heard that they know when you're remote viewing.
Oh, of course. I mean, if they are so advanced, and I've always believed this, if they can get here, they know more than we know. They know more than we'll ever know. Simple as that. Stay with us, David. We're going to be back. More of your phone calls. We're going to take phone calls for this hour and next hour right here on Coast to Coast. Your questions for guest David Hatcher Childress, what many call the modern Indiana Jones. I'm George Norrie. I'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. George Norrie back with you now on Coast to Coast AM. David Hatcher Childress, my guest. Let's go to east of the Rockies. Bob in Memphis, Tennessee. You are on Coast to Coast. Hi, Bob.
Hey. Yes, greeting sir. From home of the Blues and the barbecue kettle
of the world. Absolutely.
I wanted to mention one thing. I was introduced to the life of Edgar Casey through his grandniece in 1956.
How did that all come about?
Well, she was a fellow student where I went to high school. Her dad was the youth minister at a church here, and he was a beatnik and hippie about 10 years before they came on the scene. So he had wild parties in his home for the youth, and it was always about Uncle Edgar, which I think, like say, the girl was really the grandniece of Edgar, but I got into his books and read a great deal about his life. Later, when I married, my wife belonged to the Association for Research and Enlightenment for many years, ARE.
His organization, exactly.
Yes. Anyway, the other thing I wanted to mention was in 1965, while serving in the military police in Italy, my wife worked with another girl at the Corps of Engineers. Her boyfriend was a very wealthy Italian. And one night at dinner, he had mentioned at his church, they had found a altar about 30 feet in 900 years prior to any knowledge of the church. So after dinner, we drove up there. It was about 9:30 when we got to the church.
Mm-hmm.
He went into the parishioner's house and got the padre out, and we had a tour of this find. What I suppose were grand archways, I had to duck to get in. I'm only 5'11". The cats that were there, they found out, were really people mentioned in Dante's Inferno that they had previously thought were fictional. But the caskets remind me of something a child would be in.
They were that small?
Yes. Although...
So this was like a giant tomb underground, right? With rock cut? I mean, with, you know...
Yeah, what were the caskets made from, Bob?
Marble.
Marble.
Yeah. And like I say, the people were so small that it was unimaginable to me that they could have been great knights and princesses and whatnot, but they were all identified.
And this was found in Italy?
Yes, in Lucca, Italy, at a temple, a church in Lucca.
Now, there's a mission. Thanks for the call, Bob. There's a mission, David, that you would have loved to have been on.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, I mean, they're always finding all kinds of weird stuff like this. And, I mean, in the past, there were giants. I mean, people who were 7, 8, 9 feet tall with weird long heads and stuff. And there were also all these little people, too.
Yeah.
And, in fact, in my book on Lost Cities in North and Central America, there's a... very curious photo of this mummified, like, mini person who was blown out of a cliff during a demolition in Wyoming years ago. And it's known as the Wyoming Mummy, and it was this little man. And photos of him exist, although his location of where he is now is a mystery. But, yeah, and it was just this perfectly mummified person.
How
but
small
they were was? They were only like a 3 foot high tall person, but otherwise, you know, it's quite strange. There are also talks, you know, he reminded me when.
Of course, we still have small people now too, you know. And,
that's right. I mean, know. And then it shows you the vast diversification of humans. Look at dogs. You know, all dogs are from the same breed, and yet, you know, you have got all these little tiny mini toy dogs right up to giant Irish wolfhounds and stuff like that. And they're all, like, genetically linked and the same, and they can even interbreed, incredibly, from the biggest to the smallest. And apparently, you know, in the past, humans were like that, too, to where many humans, Cro-Magnon man was, you know, typically 7.5 feet tall, had a bigger brain than we have, strode around. He was a handsome, good-looking guy with handsome, good-looking, you know, wife and stuff like that. But at the same time, there were all these, like, weird dwarves, midgets, pygmies running around, and, you know, some of them were only 4 feet tall or something.
I just got an email about the Book of Enoch, part of the biblical days, and they say that there was reference about flying machines in that book.
Yes, right. The Book of Enoch is a fascinating book, and in fact, part of the Book of Enoch is where he is taken up into space, and he sees the Earth from a distance and stuff and describes it. Enoch is one of the few people of the Bible who was not ever known to have died and was translated. Like the Old Testament talks about all these guys, Noah and Methuselah, you know, these guys live like 800, 900 years or something, supposedly. But guys like Enoch never died.
No, never did. Let's go west of the Rockies, Seattle, Washington. Ty, welcome to Coast to Coast. Ty.
Hello, George. How are you?
Yes, sir. Real well. Thank you.
I have two questions. Number one, what is the opinion of the author of the newly found sunken city off the coast of western Cuba? And would he regard the Ark of the Covenant as a radio or telecommunications device? I'll take the answer off there. Thank you.
Okay. All right. We touched a little bit about the Cuban find, but let's elaborate for Ty's benefit,
sure,
if you would.
Sure. Yeah, Ty, earlier in the show we talked about that Cuban find. Yeah, I think that's very authentic. That's a real exciting find. 2,000 feet deep off the western coast of Cuba on the way to the Yucatan. To me, this is very significant. I would love to go down in one of those subs and find that. They've just released the sonar photos.
Wouldn't that be eerie down there? Isn't it strange when you do that?
Well, I haven't ever done it myself. I mean, I'm a scuba diver and stuff, but going down that deep, yeah, I think that's kind of scary. And brings me back to those old Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea TV shows that I used to watch. Yeah,
absolutely. And the Ark of the Covenant, you talked again about it being electrified. Some
right.
people said, was it a battery?
I believe the Ark of the Covenant was a high-tech, ancient device. Whether it was a radio transmitter or something like that, yeah, that's possible. you know, apparently it did have electricity, and people who touched it were apparently electrocuted and things like that. The whole thing of the Ark of the Covenant is fascinating. It was an important device. The Ark itself was a box and did generate an electric current, and then other things were inside it.
Well, they say the Ten Commandments are in there.
Well, supposedly fragments of the Ten Commandments, the rod of Aaron, some of the manna that fell from heaven. It's said, and I talk about this a bit in my Lost Cities books and Technology of the Gods, that has a chapter on ancient electricity, that one of the important things that was in the Ark of the Covenant was this solid gold statue of two angels facing each other, and they're holding a bowl between them. And in that bowl was a light, and that light is called in the Bible the Shekinah glory. And apparently, I mean, it was either an electrical thing or a psychic thing, too. One aspect is that in this, what they call the Tabernacle of the Wilderness, that people were led one by one into this inner sanctum, and they were shown what was this golden statue as part of the Ark of the Covenant. And they were asked people what they saw. And if they described this light, this flame, called the Shekinah glory, in this bowl between the two angels that were holding this bowl, then they believed that the person was psychically developed, and then they would go through a special training then.
Really?
So, you know, these are part of the things. Look, in my mind, definitely in ancient times, they had what we would, you know, call radios, TVs, special receivers. They probably use liquid crystal display type stuff, not the radio, like tubes, the tube televisions that we have, but more the advanced ones that we're using in computers, and the giant plasma screens, in fact, as they're called. And so they had all that. Whether the Ark of the Covenant exactly was one of those things, I'm not necessarily convinced that, but it was some kind of a high-tech device.
Let's go now to the wild card caller in Berkeley, California. Hello, Sheila. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I had a great bit of interest on this subject, and then I was really happy to hear the guy talk about hypnosis and trance states and his experience as a hypnotist with the woman that he was working with. And I found it kind of interesting that he called, and you know, right after I called, and there was something that I was thinking about that, because I was gonna tell you, you know, that for some reason, you know, I would after some years of learning trance and just meditation and self hypnosis, I get these ideas a lot, like things like in quantum physics and anthropology and how it's all connected, and all of a sudden it's like something will occur to me in the middle of the day. And a lot of that has to do with things like what kind of power other places used, and including Atlantis, and I'm noticing things like, I noticed how Tesla had picked up on that stuff, and I'm beginning to come to the conclusion that he was, you know, pretty much murdered over money. You know, I mean, obviously, not just because of what he was finding, but, you know, it could have been directly that. And the other things that when I think about the Atlanteans, I think about how it might be possible, and I don't know this because, like I say, I'm not a professional anthropologist, nor have I ever taken a course of it in high school or college or even read about it. This stuff just, you know, occurs to me. I wonder, though, that if there have been different species of humans on Earth before we were, as if there would be, between the ice ages, other kind of humans that would somehow develop or, as life evolved and evolved maybe much faster than we think it did, you know, rather than us having to take so long to come from the chimps, or if that was in fact true, you know. And I wonder even if the Atlanteans, as they were evolving, stumbled on this form of electricity and didn't even bother with the other kind of electricity. Maybe they never even ran into AC, you know.
They probably didn't need it.
Well, obviously, they would have, because ours is so much more harmful. We've got the EMF stuff, and so, because we're always noticing how these people seem to have some kind of evolved stuff, you know, and that really makes me think, if they were different humans. And as far as reincarnation is concerned, I mean, I happen to personally have a lot of personal experiences with it, and I go pretty much believing it, but then there's always that one in a million chance that, hey, I just could be wrong, you know. But I also, you know, regarded that it as you said about Tesla maybe being a reincarnated Atlantean, you know, there may be a possibility of that, and in some ways we'll never know. But he doesn't have to be reincarnated to be picking up on that energy and what was going on, and just being a scientist and going out that way and just somehow tapping into the celestial atmosphere of all that information, which sometimes happens to me, you know. And I wonder whether it was one or the other. But I also notice, as a theologian, I notice this stuff in biblic scripture, in Vedic literature, and in a lot of old, you know, stuff that was, you know, I like to look at the oldest stuff that was written, you know, stuff that's the pre-Christian, you know, the books of Jude, even the stuff that Jesus read, you know, things like that. And because, you know, I'm really, you know, into the interfaith thing, and I think the religion, and I think that this energy stuff, including electronics and all that, to me, it's all part of the same. It's all part of the same thing, and it's all connected to our consciousness.
Absolutely. Well, David, if you had the ability to go back in the time, what would you want to see?
That's a good question.
Well, yeah, I would love to go back to Atlantis and the capital and see all these things working. I'd love to get into a Vimana, one of the airships, and supposedly they called them Valixes in Atlantis, according to Lemurian Fellowship. And
well, I would like to go back, I think, to that period as well. I think that would be just truly unbelievable.
You know, I mean, the whole idea, you mentioned all kinds of stuff, but yeah, the whole idea of Tesla being this reincarnated Atlantean and...
You talked about that a couple hours ago, and, you know, that by itself is kind of thought-provoking, because I've always believed that people carry some kind of schooling with them for maybe a past life, a past soul life, and Tesla may have had that ability.
Well, you know, I mean, it depends on whether you believe general in reincarnation or not, and I am a believer in that, and of course Edgar Cayce was, and generally, metaphysics, we're all reincarnated, including Tesla and every scientist and person you can imagine. And in fact, in a way, we're all reincarnated Atlanteans. And in many ways, America, particularly, is, I think, the reincarnated Atlantis. And that's good and bad. Atlantis was a highly technical civilization, supposedly, in the past, one that at one point was very spiritual and definitely a world leader during its time of, you know, 12,000 B.C. or whatever. But at the same time, they became arrogant and powerful and warlike and kind of took over the world. Now, in many ways, you know, we're repeating much of the same, and it's our challenge as Americans, and we are all those things again, world leaders and highly technical. And it's to kind of balance ourselves and be spiritual and at the same time live in the world and use technology appropriately. And I think that means going back to some of Tesla's early ideals and technology. I'm a major proponent of that, Tesla technology.
Well, how come we never did it after that?
You know, and that's a great question, and one I address frequently. Today, oil companies control the world. I mean, we are energy and power, oil. It's the world's industry. What drives the world today, in fact, is energy companies and military and the military-industrial complex. In fact, much of what's, you know, developed in the aerospace industry and in the high-tech world in general is done by the military. And eventually it comes out 50 years later, you know, into the civilian sector, and we start using it then. Because of the unstable nature of the planet and people's special interests, the fact that we just simply can't get along with each other, and this has nothing to do with America. America is a pretty good example of how we should try to get along with each other, no matter how different we are. And the rest of the world, it doesn't seem to work as well as it does in America. Well, you know, getting it right, being ourselves, being spiritual, and learning from our mistakes that we've done in past lives.
Absolutely. Got enough energy for one more hour of phone calls, David?
Sure.
All right. Stand by. I'm George Norrie, and that's exactly what we'll do next hour. We'll take more of your phone calls from my guest, David Hatcher Childress. Back with you now on Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with my guest, David Hatcher Childress, and let's go right back to the phones. First-time caller in Lewiston, New York, Matt. Thanks for holding. You're on Coast to Coast, Matt.
Hello, George. How are you tonight?
Good. Thank you.
Good. I've got two quick questions for your guest, so I'll be fast. The first is, did I hear him mention that Tesla had designed a power plant in Niagara Falls that's still operating today?
I said that was the first power plant built. Yeah, that one's probably not the one he built is operating today, but yeah, the updated version is still there, sure.
And what he still, what was his revolution? Was he the one who introduced AC current over DC current? What was his big contribution to shipping power long distance?
Yes, exactly. Tesla was basically a Yugoslav immigrant to the United States back in about 1888 or so. He worked for Edison, but he is the one who envisioned AC power, which is today is generated by what we call three-phase motors, rotating magnetic fields. And AC power is a type of a pulsed power, and one that you can send into the atmosphere. Edison championed DC, but it was Tesla who created and promoted, of course, AC power, what we use today.
He was right.
That's right. And his partner was Westinghouse, George Westinghouse, who basically paid Tesla back then like $1 million for all the patents to Tesla's AC power. It's interesting, this caller right here, because it shows how, I mean, probably the greatest inventor who ever lived was Nikola Tesla. And, I mean, myself, I was an honor roll student. I got science awards. I knew when I graduated high school that, you know, Edison had invented the electric light bulb.
Yeah,
and
nobody ever talked about Tesla.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you learn that Otis invented the elevator and Marconi invented the radio and all this, but you don't learn about probably the most important inventor, and that is Nikola Tesla. And he's a suppressed person, I believe. And, if you go to electrical engineering school and get a degree in electrical engineering, you will have to know who Nikola Tesla is. But otherwise, you probably wouldn't, unless you listen to the Art Bell Show.
Well, that's true. Wild card caller, let's go out to Perrysburg, Ohio. Dean, you're on Coast to Coast. Welcome.
How you doing?
Okay.
I wanted to mention, Mr. Childress, I spoke to you some years ago when some of your books were in the Unlimited Book Company, had ordered your books and enjoyed immensely.
They're still at the Adventures Unlimited Book Company, you bet.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wanted to mention to you, I had known Edgerton Sykes, who was the previous world authority on Atlantis.
Yeah, sure, Edgerton Sykes, yeah, what a super guy. I didn't know him. It was great that you did. And he donated his library to the Edgar Cayce Foundation.
I got his journals, and I've got 5,000 references of his. I was the first scholar to that library as far as when they had received it. And basically, I have built on that information. I do have a website, but I'm not going to mention the location right now.
No,
I would like to leave it with you when I do leave.
Good.
Very quickly.
Send me an email. Go to our website, through the Arbel website, and send me an email, please. I'd love to see your website.
Sure.
Okay, that's the way we'll do it.
Two quick things, and I have to mention very quickly. The Azores, they found 250 miles southwest of it from an oil rig group looking for oil, 9 pillars on a platform. They said it was a couple thousand feet underwater. The other thing in the report outside of the Cuba, it seems to be a little too recent to qualify as Atlantis immediately. But I wanted to mention there was a new theory on television about the tsunami, the mega tsunamis, about volcanic rock that could split off after volcanic activity and cause huge mega floods and waves about a half a mile high. And I thought, some things are coming to light in science that are bringing some issues even more so to the forefront. I wanted to just, congratulate you with your work, and I'll get a hold of you sometime.
All right, great. Thanks for the call. Who was Colonel Percy Fawcett, David?
Well, Edgerton Sykes would have known him probably. Fawcett, whom, yeah, does have a chapter in my book on Atlantis and the power system of the gods. He was one of the role models, perhaps, for Indiana Jones. He was a British Army colonel who was very much a mystic, believed in Atlantis. He was hired, incredibly, he was a famous guy back in the 20s. He was hired by the Brazilian government and the Bolivian government and the Peruvian government through the British government to delineate the Amazon borders of all those countries in this incredibly remote area. Those areas are still remote today, although their borders are on maps, and it's thanks to Colonel Fawcett, basically. Mm-hmm. But Fawcett disappeared in 1925 on an expedition into the eastern jungles of Peru and Brazil. He was in Brazil, in fact, and looking for a lost city. But he also maintained, it's a little bit complicated to get into briefly on the radio right now, but he maintained also that there was this power system that we're talking about, a Tesla-type system that was in Atlantis that broadcasted power. And in this bizarre book that I talk about, an Atlantis power system of the gods called The Fate of Colonel Fawcett, he describes himself wandering about in Atlantis with these giant towers around that were allegedly putting this power into the atmosphere. So,
what do you think happened to it?
Well, in his case, yeah, he vanished. He became the archetypal lost explorer and lost expedition out looking for the lost city in the jungle. Looking for Atlantis, literally.
You think he got lost? Or?
Well, apparently he was captured by an Indian tribe there in the jungle who kept him and his son and their companion, Raleigh Rimmel, captive for some years. And what basically comes out, this is the most popular theory, and I support it myself, is that, yeah, he was held captive near to a lost city in the jungle, and that's another story with these cities in the Amazon jungle with these lights that never go out, that just glow all night, that kind mm-hmm. of a thing. But the Indians there were afraid that if they let him and his companions go, this is back in the, you know, late 1920s, that they would bring more and more explorers with them, and that their lifestyle in this remote part of the Amazon would be destroyed, and then they were right. So, that goes on even today, you know, 70 years later. So,
west of the Rockies, let's go to San Jose, California now. Michael, you're on the air. Hi, Michael.
Hello there.
Yes, sir.
Once again, I would, let's see, well, never mind that. I would like to throw one thing out. Granville T. Woods, I'm sure that your guest is aware of him. He is an African-American who developed the filament in the light bulbs that we currently used, developed the traffic lights that we currently used, ran neck and neck with Edison, and has 80 patents that are presently in the Westinghouse Museum.
Oh, well, okay, fascinating. I've heard about him, but I don't know that much about him. That's great.
Okay.
There's another case where the media has put a thumb on the poor guy, and nobody knows about him.
Yeah, really, another suppressed person, a suppressed inventor, yeah.
One more thing that I would like to throw out as a question to your guest.
Go ahead.
Okay, and he was speaking in regards to reincarnation. I wanted to throw out this hypothesis to him. What if it is not reincarnation, but it is the fact that we only use such a small portion of our brain, and what is actually taking place is that primal memories of our ancestors are what we are calling up, and that might be what Tesla was calling up.
That's possible.
In regards to his genius.
Let's get a little metaphysical for a moment, David. What do you think?
Yeah, right. Well, I've heard that before. That was the whole idea of genetic memory and stuff was a popular idea back in the 20s and the 30s, in fact, Tesla's peak time. And kind of goes back to eugenics and things like that, where people have these racial memories and things that went back to their ancestors and whatnot. My answer to that is that I'm an unabashed mystic. I've spent part of my life living in India. I consider myself something of a Buddhist and a believer in reincarnation. And we don't use that much of our brain, and that's part of the thing. We're only using that 20% or 10% or whatever it is. We need to use all of our brain capacity. But I'm not a believer in the genetic memory thing. I feel that genetics are kind of, personally, there's a lot of emphasis is put on genetics that's, I think, not so important. And I believe that, you know, who we are and what we are and our personalities and the way we think, I mean, it has a lot to do with our early life and who we are, you know, in this lifetime. But a lot of it has to do with past lives, where we've been, what we have to learn. I'm a firm believer in that, but I know I can't convince other people. You either believe it or not.
Oh, I believe that. I was talking to a chap from India yesterday, and I was in shock. He doesn't believe in reincarnation. Totally, totally against it.
Well, George, it's interesting with the whole thing of ancient India and Vimanas and the Ramayana. Many Indians are, and they're very scientific. Some of the best physicists and computer programmers and guys like that they're from India. But you know what? They're almost embarrassed by their own culture because guys like me go, oh yeah, ancient India and all these Vamanas and Rama and Krishna and all that stuff. And they're going, oh, they don't even want to talk about that. They're embarrassed by it because now they belong to the Church of Science now, you know.
Well, it's just like you tell an Egyptian that maybe they didn't build the pyramids. They don't want anything to do with it. They don't want to hear that. Let's go east of the Rockies, Hamilton, Ontario. Gerald, we are finding you on Coast to Coast. Hi, Gerald.
Yes, good morning, George and
mm-hmm.
David. I hope everyone is well.
We are well.
Good. Two things I'd like for your guest, and then I got one for you.
Okay.
David, the Oblast, could they be receivers for radio waves from you know where?
Hey, that's a good idea. Yeah, I think these obelisks, they're antennas, and antennas can be transmitters and receivers, of course. So, yeah, they really are both. That's a good point.
Yeah, and the other thing is, in the book of Ezekiel, the spaceships, what is your idea on that?
Yeah, the circles within circles. My co-author in Atlantis and Power System of the Gods, Bill Clendenin, I mean, his whole thing about these Mercury vortex generators, it's exactly that. I mean, these things are toroids, they're vortex movements of these electrified mercury gases called plasmas. They're bright lights that are rotating, much like what Ezekiel would describe. I mean, my own version of this kind of scenario is that guys like Ezekiel and Enoch are essentially being taken up into space in what we would call historical times, 1000 BC, 2000 BC, something like that. And they're being taken up in what is probably a Vimana that's at this point, you know, like 8,000 years old. And part of my idea, too, and what I claim is that the ancients built things to last. There was no planned obsolescence in their constructed machines.
You mean they didn't sell extended warranty plans on anything?
Yeah, the 10,000-year warranty plan, you know, or 10 billion light-years, you know, whichever comes first. But, these crafts were...
Do you think it could have been a spaceship?
Very well made.
Do you think it could have been a spaceship?
Oh, sure, it was a spaceship. These crafts are a spaceship. You know, the whole thing, was it aliens on the spaceship? Well, maybe. We're aliens, too. It's the whole idea of, like, where we're from. I mean, we are those aliens, I think, although we're from this planet as well. We're also genetically engineered, and at the same time, there's evolution as well. It's kind of like, you know, it's not either or with a lot of this stuff. It's kind of and because the whole idea too that when you get into our solar system and what's going on here and then and you know going there beyond to the galaxy and stuff, there's a with our solar system there's a missing planet and there's a mathematical theorem that they call Bode's law, and if you take Bode's law, which basically would show that as you go out from the sun, there should be a planet at certain distances as you go out from the sun.
Sure.
And Bode's law actually works very well with our solar system, the one we know best. But there's one problem with Bode's law, and that is that Bode's law shows that there should be a planet between Mars and Jupiter, but there's not a planet there. Instead, there's the asteroid belt. There's
either,
all these rocks in space.
It either blew up or it never formed.
That's right. I mean, so there you have the asteroid belt, what is apparently this planet that blew up. And Zachariah Sitchin has a kind of different version of this. He also has this, you know, Planet X coming out and Tiamat and Marduk and stuff. But what I'm talking about is different than that, and that in the sense that it would be a solar system where there would be a planet having a normal orbit, much like Earth, much like Mars, but only it's out farther than Mars, and it blew up, and now there's this asteroid belt. There's a bunch of rocks there in space. Now, one theory is, and one that I tend to go for, is that the people of that planet blew their own planet up, and that affected Mars as well, and the entire climate of Mars was adversely affected with this planet blowing up. And plus, at the same time, fragments of the planet were showered all over the solar system. That's probably some of the asteroids that struck the Earth and created, you know, some of the huge asteroid craters like the one in Arizona that's so famous. So I don't know. I mean, and even the idea that we are the people from that planet, and that from that planet we went to Mars, and then from Mars we came to Earth, and at the same time other extraterrestrials who are even from other solar systems and galaxies have come here, and they jump through hyperspace, and they're watching our progress. And I would like to think that they are spiritually developed and highly technologically developed in a good way.
I think so too, David, because eventually you're going to get to the point where somebody created them. You know, even though we may have been seeded, you got to go back to the beginning. And for those people who may not think that because you believe in the seeding of human beings theory doesn't mean that you're not spiritual or religious, because eventually you're going to get to the beginning of it. And I think that's important.
I think that's well said. And I mean, part of the idea that you have to get into and it helps to believe, I think, in reincarnation and karma, is that, you know, it's important that you do things for yourself. And yeah, sure, somebody who's more developed than you can come along and just show you everything and do everything for you, but that's not the purpose of your life. It's to do it yourself. And that is what we need to do, too. We need to learn and grow and do things ourselves, including technological things as well.
All right. Well, as they say in horse racing, we're coming around to the home stretch now, so we'll be right back. We'll take more of your phone calls, more of your questions for David Hatcher Childress. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. This is with my guest, David Hatcher Childress, and let's go to first-time caller in Eugene, Oregon. Jim, you are on Coast to Coast. Hi, Jim. Jim?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Good morning, George.
Yes, sir.
Well, first of all, I want to let you know I've been trying to get through for years and years, and this is the first time.
Yeah, you did it.
West Coast number doesn't work for me.
I don't know why not.
I get a recording that says this number has been disconnected.
Well, I don't know why. It works for everybody else.
That's what puzzles me.
Yeah.
But anyway, get to the business. As far as intelligent life out there somewhere, if they're really intelligent, they won't have anything to do with us. And if they're really, really intelligent, they'll come and kill us before we get out there.
Well, I don't think they'll kill us, but you know what? I have a feeling they're going to try to help us. We are probably very baffling to them.
We need help.
A lot of help.
About a question for your guest, Mr. Childress.
Yes, go ahead.
On this Atlantis thing, I don't have any doubts about it because Well, actually, I think that there's probably been many civilizations that have risen and fallen over time. That some we only have legends of, and some we don't even have knowledge at all of. But I'm pretty convinced of that. But as far as Atlantis itself, almost everything has a Greek name to it. And that I think that needs to take a little, be taken with a little grain of salt, because, I mean, they changed the whole body of water. You know, name-wise, and look what they did to the Bible.
Well, I just, sure.
I just want to know what the guest had to say about that. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Go ahead, David. And it's also possible that Atlantis may have been a little island near near Greece, huh?
Well, yeah, right. I mean, that's often what they say. This island that blew up in 1200 B.C., Thera or Santorini, and... is Atlantis, according to many books. You'll often see that on TV, although, you know, if you're looking for some cataclysm or some island blowing up, you don't have to go very far from Athens to find one. I mean, you go to practically the next island out there, and you suddenly have exactly that scenario. Cataclysms and stuff have occurred all over the place at various times and are very common, more common than geologists have ever wanted to admit it, but more and more they're admitting that this happens all the time. As far as the whole Greek words, what you're talking about, sure, I mean, much of modern vocabulary comes from the Greek, but it's interesting, the whole word of Atlantis and the whole A-T-L audible word, and in fact, the two languages that are mostly associated with Atlantis are, one, the Basque language, in the Pyrenees, which is, you know, today basically the Western Pyrenees with Biarritz and then into Spain, of the Basque language with all these weird X sounds, and the Nahuatl language, which is the language of Mexico City area. And Nahuatl was the language that was spoken by the Aztecs. And you have all these audible words and X words, and there's a real strong connection, I believe, between the Basques and their language. In fact, they play that strange game too, High Alai, that that you would, that the beginning of Miami Vice, they always show that in because it's played in Florida. And but that is a game that is also played by the Basques. It's also played in Central America. So, it, you know, Greek language is only a part of it, and a modern part. And in fact, you know, what we, the way we say things about Atlantis and the Atlas and those audible words comes from even earlier languages.
Do you think that we somehow lost our ability to create these kind of power systems? Are there scientists right now working on what may have been back a long time ago?
Absolutely, George. And in fact, I mean, I'm convinced, and a number of the authors with us at Adventures Unlimited, including Bruce Cathy, the New Zealand author who's written these books about the energy grid and the bridge to infinity and the harmonic conquest of space, that the American government and other governments have already recreated this entire system, which includes antennas, power stations, even this base at the South Pole that we were talking about, that also has a giant tower in it, only it goes underground instead of above ground. So the whole idea that there's already a kind of Tesla-type Atlantean system that includes power towers, antennas, a way of pulsing power into the atmosphere, and that certain, like, submarines and craft are taking power from this stuff. Yeah, I believe it's already happened, and in a modern way.
I get a lot of emails from people around the country, David, and they talk about hearing a strange low hum sound. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah, right. No, I'm familiar with that. The Taos hum, and in Ohio, there's a similar one.
Yes.
You know what? I would, my own explanation to that, and I've been very interested in hearing all about that. My explanation for that is that it's very real, that hum, and probably has to do with underground tunneling that's going on in the vicinity of where they're hearing that hum. Taos, New Mexico is definitely an area where some kind of underground tunneling is happening. Right around Sandia Peak, and Dulce, New Mexico are well-known underground facilities that are being built by the U.S. government. When these giant tunnel-boring machines are moving through the ground, I mean, this is what they create, is a low vibrational hum and stuff like that. And it's
like that,
coming
yeah.
from deep underground, and people are picking this up. And it's probably in many more locations than we're being reported, like Taos in Ohio. But, yeah, it's from, I believe, these underground installations and the continuing tunneling that's going on.
Let's go out to Cleveland, Ohio on the wildcard line. Mike, you are on Coast to Coast. Do you hear that hum out that way, Mike?
I'm only in my sleep.
All right. Go ahead.
Good morning, George and David.
Yes, sir.
Hey.
Oh, Dave, you're great. I first got exposed to you in that little anti-gravity handbook.
Yeah, thanks.
It's interesting in there. You see Bruce Cathy makes that diagram of how those monks use sound or, you know, chanting and those instruments to catapult those rocks up onto that bluff.
Right, and, you know, sound and vibration are key to all this stuff, I think.
One of the things I thought always was interesting is how an onk resembles a tuning fork.
Mm-hmm.
And tonight you were talking about these obelisks actually maybe being transmitters of a frequency.
That's right, and that they're specially cut to certain frequencies and tuned using those tuning forks. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, yeah.
We're always looking for something electronic that has a kind of a body of guts to it, but maybe the guts of the technology back then was, like you said, was just gold.
Very simple, exactly.
Well, you know what, and that's a really good point, in that high technology doesn't necessarily have to be more clattering, you know, pistons and clankety-clank engines. High technology is smooth and quiet and has to do with resonance and frequency and crystals. Electricity is absolutely part of it. Tuning forks, the idea that antennas and obelisks are a certain size and a certain height and have a certain, you know, tuned frequency. This is all part of their science.
Sir, if I may, one more.
Yes, you may.
The blown nodes of the crop circles, the Levengood fellow says that they only can simulate that damage by exposing it to a kind of a pulse microwave frequency, and you're always on the verge of either cooking the plant or not getting the effect. And I believe that it's a frequency or a wave or a sound that is at the core of this phenomena. That's not to say what the phenomena means. But you have all this experience of going around the world, and all these ancient cultures were into these sacred circles. There was an etched Sriyantra in the Oregon Desert back in 92, reported in the UFO magazine that you can get as a back issue. There was no way anyone could have etched that in the dry desert bed. These artists tried to claim that they hoaxed it, yet...
I remember that, yeah, right. I haven't thought about it that much, but I remember when that happened, yeah. That
with the
curious.
Phenomena getting to the point that...
It wasn't in a crop, but it was just etched onto, like, desert sand or something like that?
Correct. It was on the hard basin floor itself. Mm. It was near an Air Force base, so that's the cloud that would have kicked up trying to create that, etching it out, pulling something behind a station wagon, they would have got the attention of security, the Air Force base, and the commander said there was nobody out there 2 hours away from us, you know, milling around for a week long. We would have known. And what I did, that's not why I called to make that point. But you've got all this reference, and I think that Linda Moulton Howe is into these sacred objects and symbols as a way to maybe derive some type of understanding of this phenomena, because, you know, with like UFOs, all we have are stories, but we actually have evidence of a phenomena with these crop circles, and, you know, we're always looking to the past for some meaning, and I think if we could create some great big comparison of this past to this current phenomena, I think you could be a key person in maybe illuminating some understanding here, sir. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Mike. You know, Mel Gibson is coming out with a movie in August, David, called Signs, which is
That's
going
right.
to be based
yeah,
on crop circles.
Yeah,
I've got to see that.
That'll
be great. Yep. Let's go west of the Rockies in Arizona, Phoenix. Sam, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi, Sam.
Enjoying very much your show.
Thank you.
You know the best. And would like to mention that in Science News that I am subscribed for over 20 years, I have read about a Russian scientist being subscribing more to the catastrophe theory, while U.S. and Western scientists were subscribing to slow changes Well, evidence is probably that it is happening both ways. Now, I'm 70, and I do recall I was, in fact, in Europe at the time. I believe it was 1972 when an earthquake hit, I think it's Algerian city of Agadir, and that's the southern part of Mediterranean, of course. And the epicenter was not in the city, it was off the coast. And I do recall that they reported in the newspapers that the depth of the sea in that area was 500 meters or 1,500 feet. And then after the earthquake, the depth was like 6,000 feet.
Wow.
In other words, it went about, more like 7,500 feet. It went for about 6,000 feet down in a matter of about 24 hours.
It cracked the planet wide open.
That's right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You know what? And similar things like that that you know, I report in my books, just talking about Atlantis and the Atlantic ocean floor, when they laid these cables across the Atlantic, you know, early on in the turn of the century, and they would occasionally go and check these cables, and these were entire cables that were laid, you know, from like Nova Scotia to England or something, completely across the Atlantic. But sometimes they would be, they would go out and periodically check them, and they would be at depths of thousands of feet and things like that. But occasionally, they would go to check parts of the cable where it was supposed to be that, and they would find that the ocean floor had changed dramatically and was suddenly, hundreds or thousands of feet different than it had been before. And it just shows you how the Earth can change.
Oh,
and even we're not even aware of it. Two-thirds of the surface of the Earth is water. One-third of the surface is the Pacific Ocean, in fact. I mean, what happens, we're basically a water planet. I mean, only one-third of our planet is above water. A lot of geological change is happening underwater.
It's mind-boggling. There are thousands of active volcanoes in the ocean. And just to imagine that, David, is incredible, isn't it?
It is. I mean, imagining our own planet, it's... Look, we're really in an age of information. The Internet and the radio is great. Maps, more than ever, more and more people are just interested in what's going on and in the climate, in how things are changing on a day-to-day basis. And it's not something that's just happening now. The Earth has constantly been going through climatic change. I mean, it's the history of this planet, one of devastating cataclysms, of migrations of people, of mass extinctions of animals and plants, of people, the sun rising at a different place than it rose before, of huge ice caps, you know, going over parts of the planet, of people moving to a place where they can live and grow crops.
We've been generally pretty lucky.
Well, you know what? The last 200 years, which is when all this tremendous progress has taken place. I mean, it's really only been in the last 100 years or so that this amazing technology has all come into our lives. And, I mean, we've gone to the moon, and we're supposedly, you know, space-faring nation and planet now. And although, as you go around the world, many countries are not ready for that at all. But we've moved so fast. And this is a good point about Atlantis that I'd like to make as we get towards the end of the show, is that think how fast, technologically, we've come in 100 years. Now, look, couldn't we come this fast, in 12,000 B.C. or 14,000 B.C.? And if we did, I mean, would it only be a few hundred years that we would have be a flash in the pan where we've come into all this technology and then destroyed ourselves? That's much the story of Atlantis.
Quick call in Tennessee. Bill, you still with us? You're on Coast to Coast.
Speak to you today.
Yes, sir.
I just had a couple of questions out of the Bible. I'm not going to preach.
Okay.
But there's mysterious words that surprised me, like in the sixth day creation. It said, go and replenish the earth. Could that not have been somewhere before that, the end of the third age and the flood of Noah?
Absolutely.
In the end of the fourth age, and we are now in the fifth age.
Right.
That's very possible. And, you know, and it all comes down to, David, terminology, interpretation, and just reading your books. You've done a great job interpreting. When you go and travel to various parts of this world, and you're on these expeditions and you search, do you take down notes, or do you come back and try to remember everything, and then you start writing? How do you handle that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, I take notes and photographs, and go to museums. I'm a book buyer, too. I spend thousands of dollars every year buying books, and I've one of the great rare book collections in the world, probably.
Do you?
Hey, knowledge is, you know, it's...
It's priceless.
It's priceless. I can only say, go out to all your listeners, you know, listen to our Bell Show, and try and find out, you know, what's true. And you can only know by being knowledgeable. Read a lot. Be aware, aware of what these other people are talking about. It's fascinating. That's what's important about the Bible, in fact, is that knowledge has been destroyed. And throughout history, I mean, entire libraries are purposely burned and destroyed. And so books like the Bible and the ancient Indian epics and the Popol Vuh, whatever we have, are especially important to us.
David, it has been a pleasure, and it's been fun talking with you. Let's do this again another time, okay? David Hatcher Childress. Hey, for J.D. Smith, Michael Kincaid, Lisa Lyon, Delani Conrad, Keith Rowland, the webmaster, Howard Morton and Alan Corbett, I'm George Norrie. Have a great day, everyone. And don't forget, 1 week now of positive thinking, and then email me next week and let me know how your week went. Be safe, everyone.